the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got the one and only Scott Gershon.
Hi, Mike. I was going, wait a minute, I'm first.
And next to him, we've got Brandon Birdside.
Hey, Mike.
And yes, next to Brandon, we've got, for the second show in a row, ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Sheps.
Hi, Mike. Wow. Apparently it's a big deal. I need to not show up for a long time more often.
That's right. And then you'll get a round of applause.
Yeah.
And next to Andrew, we've got the one and only, the man, the myth, Rob Arbatier.
Hello, Mike. What a letdown. What a total letdown.
Wow.
That was depressing.
I felt that for you.
Yeah, thank you.
The one and only Rob Arbatier.
Yeah!
Woo! I didn't get myself.
Rob, this is show number 91.
Is it really?
And he's been to 92 shows.
Yeah. Yeah, that time I parked outside and no one else showed up.
Yeah. The Audio Nowcast is a podcast where we talk about the audio industry. And
we know a podcast? Because, you know, anyway, go ahead.
Wow.
The iPad.
And apparently we tell a really bad joke.
You're going to have to wait in the car.
Joining us today, we have some great guests. We are honored to have, well, first of all, we're honored to have Gary Meraz with us. Gary was one of our first guests back in year two-ish, so somewhere around podcast
19 or 20.
Yeah, somewhere around there. And Gary's back, and he did a whole great podcast, if you want to go back and listen to the archives, on binaural audio with his Studio Voodoo.
Surround sound, DTS,
etc. Really great, really good stuff. And welcome back, Gary.
Thank you very much.
And Gary brought a friend. And
we didn't even know Gary had a friend.
Yes, one friend.
And he's here.
We are honored to have musician, producer, author, Bobby Osinski with us.
Bobby.
Hi, guys.
Hi, guys.
And let me tell you, Bobby, for one thing, is a fantastic author. He's written books that I'm sure most of you out there have heard about and or read, The Mixing Engineer's Handbook, which is a staple in a lot of schools' courses for mixing. And he's also written The Mastering Engineer's Handbook and The Recording Engineer's Handbook, as well as his new book, Music 3.0. Is that your new book?
No. No, my new one is The Music Producer's Handbook.
Wow.
Yeah. Actually, I'm working on my 13th book right now.
13th.
Wow.
Wow. See, I'm behind.
Just go straight to the 14th one.
Yeah, that's right. You're still on the first one, yeah.
But we are honored. Thank you so much for joining us, Bobby.
Thank you for asking me. It's cool.
And we're going to be visiting with Bobby and getting to talk a little bit about, Music 3.0, apparently, you know, a book that he wrote 19 years ago.
Well, it was only last year. It's still pertinent.
So thank you for joining us. Right off the bat, I just want to start. We're going to dig into it. This past weekend, I went to Vegas, and I got to see Wang Chung, one of my favorite bands from the 80s.
Did you Wang Chung?
I did. I had fun tonight, and I
Wang
Chung.
But you're not supposed to tell us, you know, that was Vegas, stays in Vegas.
No, it was really great. Had a great time. It was good to see those guys going out there and playing live.
How'd they sound?
They sounded great.
Did they?
You know, the great thing about technology nowadays is you can add your backing tracks, and they had a full band with them, you know, guitar, bass, keyboards, and you really, with technology that's out, can have a really big sound. And his vocals are still fantastic. He can still sing. And
and how many times did they do Everybody Wang Chung tonight? Because I would have needed to hear it like six times.
They did the extended version, right? About an hour. Yeah.
Did they trigger everything off the Sankofa?
No, but
karaoke.
It was great. You know, it was great. They have a new EP out. They're working on a new album, and it sounds fantastic. And as a matter of fact, I talked with Jack Hughes, who's the lead singer, and he actually signed a CD to a listener here of the Audio Nowcast. So if you want this CD, I will send it to you. It's autographed by Jack Hughes, and it's the first one who sends me an email and professes their Wing Chun love.
Rob's got a couple more DP7s.
There you go.
I wanted to ask, actually, did those ever get delivered?
Our DP7.
You know what? The DMP7.
The DMP7.
I actually tripped on one of them in the garage about a month ago and thought, oh, that's still here.
Did the winner of that ever get back in touch wondering where it was?
Yeah, we talked and it just, that never worked.
Well, that's not what's going to happen with the CD.
No, as a matter of fact, our second giveaway, we gave away a little groove box. I don't know if you remembered. That made it out to the listener.
Part of the problem with the DMP7s was they just didn't work. And I took them apart to try to fix them and thought, this is going to take a month.
Yeah, I mean, sending it to someone's actually doing them a disservice.
that's just unfair.
Well, yeah. I just want everybody to know that I have the autographed CD in front of me.
Yes, he does. It's quite cool looking.
Ooh. It says, to a lucky Audio Nowcast listener.
Wow.
We love you, Jack Hughes. So send me an email, audio@nowcastnetwork.com, and put Wang Chung in the subject and... First one, literally the first one.
Should be the 57th one. So one person can go 57 times.
But as I was there and I was having a great time at the show and everything, I was thinking about our podcast because Jack, we kind of talked a little bit and we'll probably Skype him in from England because he teaches songwriting over at Cambridge, I believe. And he just would be a fantastic guest. He's just a really smart guy, very musical. Anyhow, I started thinking about the podcast and I knew we were going to have Bobby here. We were going to talk a little bit about music and where it is now, where it's been and where it's going forward. And I started to think about casualties of the progress that music is giving us. I mean, there's a lot of things that are obviously falling by the wayside, like tape and like
high resolution audio.
Yeah. But one thing that struck me was the whole oldies movement, where the whole nostalgia, where you know, back when I was a kid, it was the 50s, and then, you know, the 60s got hip, and then the 70s got hip. And as we, you know, get older, I mean, I'm wondering if some of the music industry is so fragmented now. There's so many small categories of music. If they're going to be able to turn out the, you know, glorious 2010s, you know what I mean? If they're going to have the same type of impact. Because I look at someone like Wang Chung who, you know, they had some worldwide hits and they definitely, you know, had an appeal at their time. But you just see less and less of that. Like, where are you going to pick up the used vinyl? Where are you going to pick up the used CD?
Lady Gaga.
You know? It's just, is there a used download market? I mean, what do you guys think? I mean, can you see that as being a casualty?
It is going to be pretty funny 20 years from now when people are trying to find some vintage Gaga to listen to.
I just think that's going to be a casualty. It's going to manifest itself, obviously, in some way. But Bobby, let me ask you, what do you think about that? What do you think about that whole secondhand vintage sales? I mean, do you see?
Well, you hit it right on the head because there won't be any because you can't have a rental industry built around downloads, built around files, digital files. That's one of the big problems. The other thing is I think that longevity of some of the music is very finite, unlike Wang Chung, for instance. What, they're going on 30 years now for that song, right? For the two songs, that big hits that they had. But are you going to be singing a Snoop Dogg song or rap, you know, or anything like that? It just won't have the legs. That whole era there will not have legs like some of the other songs before it. And that's, you know, one of the big problems.
I just find that interesting. Andrew, what do you think? What do you think of as the music you work on, you know, in 20 years from now?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of the music, you could argue whether or not the music is good enough to stick around. And there's still some amazing songwriters, and they might be working in genres that you wouldn't expect or you don't listen to. But unless something bizarre happens, it's not like you're going to have to go hunt it out because Lady Gaga will still be on the iTunes store. You know, you don't have to go find the old stuff. It's always going to be available unless they decide to take it down, which why would they?
You're right. That's a great.
I totally agree with Andrew that I mean, forgetting the medium, because some people fall in love with the medium, like, oh, I miss vinyl. Like, I like vinyl on a level, but I don't miss the shh, 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 the rhythmical, the noise, and all of those things. If
I
you,
do. Yeah. But that's me.
But we got plugins for that now. And I think that I love the internet for, because there's a couple artists that I was wondering, hey, whatever happened to, even like Ann Wilson from Heart.
Yeah.
You know, what have they done that's maybe something more modern? And
they just put out
a record. So I found her. She had a couple websites that she put together and heard some of their. Here's some of the songs. Here's some of the other songs. Because I heard that they came out with some music not under Heart.
Yeah.
The sisters came out with something totally different, and then I found out they have a new album out. It's having access to information. Forget about the medium, but I do think that you can find a lot of bands that record labels would never support anymore because they're no longer hip.
But you see, that's one of the problems, actually, because everything is so fragmented that now we used to be talking about songs that you would hear everywhere. You'd hear them all over the world.
Right.
Now you're going to have so many fewer of those.
Right.
Because now everything is fragmented.
But when we were growing up, I remember there was the always corporate rock or pop music that everybody hated.
Right.
Everyone was going towards the underground music from either Britain or somewhere else. And there was, I found an album. You can only get it in England. And, we got, something that's out of the mainstream. And kind of what I like now is there's so much interesting music. Forget about whatever corporate America thinks is popular that they want to sell to the masses. It's kind of like ABC, CBS, and NBC.
Right.
Here's the only shows you get, and that's it. Now you've got so many other choices. Has it fragmented? Yes. But it seems like it's given so much more opportunity to a lot of other artists. Some of it's crap, but also some of it's not.
But there are also some really interesting ways to discover music, and they're just coming online, too.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been Pandora for a bit, where you put an artist you like, it starts creating a station, and I found a lot of music on that. But then Ping, which Apple just launched, we'll see. But to be able to follow somebody whose taste you like, not necessarily a friend, but, you know, somebody, I'm assuming that every single record reviewer in the country will have a Ping that you can follow. And I mean, I don't know that much about the service, but basically I think you just recommend music and people see what you listen to. And
there is a downside of Ping that they haven't quite gotten yet. The only thing it follows is the sales. So if you buy something, then everybody can follow that. But it doesn't follow what you're listening to.
Oh, so people don't make your own list. It's only what you buy.
Well, you can make your own list, but what would be a lot more what would help people a lot more, and I think would be a more effective service, would be if you can follow what you're listening to. Because that's really what you want to know. It's not so much what you buy, because, you know, maybe people don't buy that much, but they listen a lot, which most people do, actually.
Yeah.
That's what you want to know. But Ping doesn't do that right now. That's one of the downsides of it.
Gary, were you going to say something?
Well, I was going to actually ask. He just answered. I said, well, how do you find music now? You know, that's one of the things. Is there's like you're saying, there's a lot of it, Scott. So and it's true. But how do we get through this, you know, miasma to find what we want?
I think the biggest thing, I mean, Pandora you can do passively, but it used to all be passive. You couldn't actively go find music unless you were just looking at local music that was being played in clubs. Whereas now you can actively go find 1,000 bands a day. It's not easy, and you're not necessarily going to find anything you like. But it's a much more of an active pursuit than it used to be, I think.
Well, I'll tell you a few things that I miss about finding music, and is I miss like the import section of a record store. The import section, I remember, was just a great place to find little gems and little mixes and remixes and things like that. And the other thing too is, liner notes on CDs. Because sometimes I'll be into either the producer that I like, and you can kind of hear their sound, or a specific drummer, a session drummer, and things like that. I think, you know, there's no reason why they can't figure out how to bring that kind of back with a digital booklet, but it's all going to kind of affect just how we consume music and how we buy music. And even though you're right, that's a great point, the fact that, Lady Gaga will never go away. That's actually kind of a horrible thought. But even though, that's a great point.
The big hits of the day won't go away is what you mean,
But it just seems, I mean, I'm so overwhelmed right now just on iTunes. It's not, the screen for me yet isn't really a great browsing. I still tend to like to go to Amiga. amoeba and just kind of walk up and down and kind of, you know, see what kind of
would you, do you remember eye. Bitches Brew when that album came out and you opened it up and you read who was on that and then pretty soon you started following John McLaughlin and Tony Williams and all these people you'd never heard of before and they just opened up a whole world of new music from that one piece of music and all the players.
But if you went to, I mean, I grew up in a good a lot of growing up in Phoenix. And if the record store didn't have it, it didn't exist.
Right.
So now I could sit there and say, what happened to Dixie Dregs? What happened to Star Castle? What happened to all these, like, you know, bands? And you go, oh, hey, look, you know, and they formed this band, and I didn't know they were part of that band, and you can, you know.
But you see, what Gary hit on before is discovery is a big part of the music business, and that's one of the big parts that's lacking right now. Is the one of the things that the record labels always did was they were a filter. Usually, if it was coming from a label, there was a certain level of competency, and you don't have that now. You don't have that filter, so there's a lot more music to go through. So you need this discovery aspect, and that's actually what the venture capitalists are funding right now in music. There's two things that the VCs are funding in music. It used to be if you had any kind of an online service, they'd be all over you. Now, if you have an iPhone app, they want to give you money, and if you have something that's discovery based. Then they really want to give you money because that's the next frontier.
But couldn't, like, such as what FM did to radio, like, the guy goes, hey, I heard this great new, I remember Toy Matinee.
Right.
All of a sudden the guy goes, hey, there's this band, I just got this, take a listen, this is really great.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing it going, I don't know what that is, but I got to buy it.
Yeah.
And couldn't it be that somebody creates a site or that becomes very popular, the Wolfman Jack? Of the day that says, by the way, here's what I think.
Well,
here's my recommendations.
There are already. Yeah. I mean, but it's all within genres. I mean, Pitchfork, for that kind of music, for most people, they go there. And if Pitchfork doesn't like it, they don't like it. And if they like it, they do. And that's, you know, fortunate or unfortunate. But I think one thing that would be quite cool is that if the Discovery started taking into account personnel, producers, mixers.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. Absolutely.
Because, I mean, I released an EP on iTunes last week, and there's absolutely no information. None.
Yeah.
You know.
Did you do it yourself?
Yeah.
As far as information? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I put it in, and TuneCore was very happy to take all the information and say, yeah, we're going to save that for later.
That's right.
Okay.
There's a trick to that, actually. And the trick is iTunes has what they call a producer's kit. You have to download – it's free. And you download the producer's kit and as everything that happens with Apple, they have to approve you first. And what they approve is they want to make sure that there's no porn going to be on it. And you know, it has a reasonable level of their taste. But once they approve you, you can put – you're basically a record label. And all of that stuff finally goes on there. The liner notes go on, the any kind of album photos, album artwork, all that goes on. But you need that toolkit first. That's the whole secret. Right? But if you do it through TuneCore, no, it won't get on.
Well, you know, another thing that I was watching the fantastic Wang Chung concert, and it was fantastic, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
and I want to get your guys' opinion on this, is Wang Chung actually – had about four albums. Most people know, you know, everybody Wang Chung tonight. But they've had like, there's an album called, you know, one of the first one was Points on the Curve, and they had another album before that, Mosaic, and they had one where it was Huang Chung, and they had Warmer Side of Cool. They had all these albums because back then, you know, you're a band, you have a couple hits, you know, they're going to invest in you, you're going to take more and more albums, even albums that don't do great, you know, they're going to be out there and people can buy the music. So they have a catalog. You know, you see the age of the micro career, you know, where a band will come out and if they don't hit, then boom, they're gone tomorrow. I mean, are we even going to have that many bands that have that kind of a catalog? You know, they get fractured and bands break up and, you know, I had a really good friend of mine, his band came out, had a little bit of success and then boom, they broke up and, you know, cause they didn't have any support and they were doing it on their own and they had some, it was a good album.
It's coming back. One of the things about Music 3.0, about my book, Music 3.0, is the fact that It goes through the five generations of the music business. And the very first one, Music 1.0, would be back when you had Ahmet Erdogan running the record label, and you had Clive, and you had music people, basically, that were running labels. And what they would do is, if they liked you, you'd get four albums, you'd get five albums until you hit, which, you know, there's that development process. Music 1.5, all of a sudden the conglomerates see that there's a bunch of money, and they come in and they buy up everybody. Now, also at 1.5, what happens is MTV comes in. So now they begin to look differently at music because now they're looking at your image rather than at your music. And it's image development rather than music development. Music 2.0 is when digital downloads come out. Music 2.5, well, when digital downloads come out, record labels basically stay away. Music 2.5, iTunes comes out, and finally you can monetize it. Music 3.0 is now you can get rid of all of the people in between. You get rid of the middleman, and finally the artist can reach out and touch directly the fan, and the fan can reach back. Now, what I see happening is, going back to Music 1.0, in terms of the people that run the small indie labels are music people. They're their own audience. They sign people because they love the music. So I think we're coming full circle. Now, they don't have the bread yet right to do it, but they have the drive. And I see it starting to happen. It'll take some time, but we're right in the beginning of it. We're basically in the 1950s, if you go back. You know, I was talking to Rupert Perry recently. Rupert used to be the co-chairman of EMI. Very smart guy. And he was telling me, you know, this is the same as when I first started in the 50s. And he said it used to be that a record label would be two guys with a bunch of 45s in the trunk of their car. And they'd be going out and they'd be selling them. He says now all it is, it's two guys in an office in North Hollywood that are on the computer.
Yeah.
There's the analogy.
It's almost like we're going full circle.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
But it used to be, I remember, I've said this before on the podcast, when I just graduated college, we were talking about different bands. I remember Bruce Springsteen was in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And nobody had any albums. The albums didn't exist. But everyone kept saying, dude, this guy has like a 3-hour, 4-hour concert. Everyone sees him. He's hometown kid. Everyone loves him. You got to see this guy.
Yeah.
And then albums supported the band.
Yeah.
And then albums were the band. And touring was not necessary. And then
touring was always necessary.
Well, but there were, I mean, Steely Dan. I mean, there were bands early on.
There were some, yeah.
That just became, it was all about the album. And then they had to make their live performance sound like the album. Because yeah. It all became album centric.
Part of it too was before MTV, it was okay to be ugly and
yeah.
be a band.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Sure.
And that all kind of changed.
Yeah, but Bobby, to talk about your 3.0 and the full circle is, do you think that exactly what Scott just said, that now performing is a really critical part of actually success? Now it's like imperative.
But it always has been. One of the things that I found out in researching this book is from the beginning of musical time, most of the money that musicians have made have been through touring, not through record sales. They have made money through record sales, don't get me wrong, but the vast majority has always come from touring. That hasn't changed. As a matter of fact, I've had some attorneys tell me it's been as high as 95% of their total income.
Wow.
Because the labels would steal the rest of it. And
right.
If they're a songwriter, obviously there'd be a lot coming through publishing. But if they weren't, it's mostly coming through touring. So, but even more so now, yeah, touring is important. Big problem is the touring business has taken a big hit this year, and it's as bad as the music business. It's recording music.
What do you attribute that to?
High prices, first of all.
Tickets,
but do you think it's Live Nation? Again, it seems like there's always a pure concept of, I want to do this, here's the price of the tickets. And then the scalpers get in and say, okay, here's the tickets. It was $15 to $30, and now it's $150. So now all of a sudden, like, I wanted to see the Pink Floyd concert, it's $750.
Holy smokes.
That's silly.
And I said $500 to $750. I'm like, that's crazy.
What, do they give you a free iPod with that? Or?
I mean, it's very good seats. It's in the bottom rows. But everything was like $300, $400, $500.
You know. But it's institutionalized, too, because if you go when tickets go on sale, if you go on the Ticketmaster site and try to buy them, they will be sold out unless you're incredibly lucky.
Right.
But immediately, there are hundreds of tickets available on StubHub, which is owned by Ticketmaster, and they're marked up. But this is within seconds.
Well, that's what I'm saying is, in other words, that the people that control the pipe try to find ways of...
Well, but they came in and got the record companies, and now they've come in and gotten the live touring. I mean, all of the venues are owned by the same people. You can do a tour of Live Nation venues with them doing ticket sales. They do the merch. They do the refreshments. Yeah. They do everything, and they own the venues. And you can tour the entire country just in their venues.
It's like the House of Blues circuit, too.
Yeah.
You know?
There are a bunch of them.
So you say Live Nation's good.
What I'm saying is that it's exactly the same thing of putting a corporate umbrella over the business that still makes money, and then all of a sudden there isn't enough money anymore.
As the forest of music is burnt down in record sales, and now it's happening with concerts, and those people that always look for the fast buck, the middleman, now all of a sudden they realize, you know what, there's no money in this. I don't want to do it anymore. They go away and we start again.
But do you know that if you wait, you may be able to get that ticket for $10 because all throughout the country there's been major acts that haven't been able to sell out this year where at the last minute they've been papering the audience like the papering the venue like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, just
where
so
they're
it's
10,
not empty.
15. Yeah, that's right. They've been so you can get tremendous deals. Now I don't know if Pink Floyd is gonna be like that, but it's worth a try.
Yeah, I'll tell you, ticket prices, you know, I think it's responsible for a lot of that because on the other end of the scale, I went to go take my family to go see Weird Al Yankovic. And the most expensive ticket right up front, $25.
Oh, that's great.
In the back, it was $12.50.
That's great.
I got my whole family in the back.
And it was sold out, I'm sure.
It was sold in two nights. I mean, that you know, I happen to know the management for Weird Al, and I've worked on some Weird Al stuff, and they're just smart people for one thing. But that is such a smart way to do it. He knows his market. It's families with kids. And, you know, it's better to do two nights that are sold out than one night of expensive tickets that's three quarters.
And on top of that, he engenders so much goodwill with his fans that they will line up to buy his records because he's such a good guy making it affordable to go to the show.
Yeah. And I will say, too, that and this is a positive thing with technology and moving forward is, you know, especially live, you get a better product and it's not costing as much money to do, the show visuals as it used to be. I mean, touring now, you don't have to have a big set. You get you rent a screen that you can put behind you, you throw some visuals up. It adds way more impact than any type of, you know, big set that you used to have in days gone by. So you have less trucks. And then, and then the sounds that you can get.
It's also nice when you can actually see the band.
Yeah.
Rather than see a big video screen of the band and they all look like ants.
And the sound that you can get now is fantastic. PAs are smaller and way more powerful than they used to be. I mean, the rig that they had for, like the Martina McBride rig was, I think it was the Clare Brothers, their latest, set of speakers, and basically they were smaller and way more powerful than they've ever been, and it sounded great. So you get better sound, you get better production. You know, I just think if people wouldn't price the ticket so much, you'd sell a lot more, and that could save touring.
Well, the latest scandal, basically, through all of this is the fact that they've found out that the artists are responsible for a lot of this because artists, management, and the promoter all get X amount of tickets that they can keep for themselves. Now, this has been going on forever, but now what's been happening is they themselves sell them to the ticket brokers. So that's how they make extra bread. So they'll basically say, okay, it's a $100 ticket, give me $300, right? So they've just made $300 on those tickets, and then, of course, they're going to turn around and sell them for $750.
Right.
And that's one of the big scandals that's finally come to light. And I think, Bruce Springsteen got hit with this the beginning of the summer. And he immediately turned around and said, I wasn't aware this was happening. He went back to management and they stopped the process. And he went and he refunded all sorts of money and he got back in the good graces of everybody. But not everybody else. Bon Jovi especially. There's a big Bon Jovi thing where they found out that he was making tons of extra money by taking these tickets and basically backdooring them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, Roger Waters did something interesting recently. He's on tour. I don't know if that's what
that's
you're
what he has to do, Roger Waters,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. He did something interesting where instead of – it was before. It was like a pre-sale of a pre-sale just for fans who were signed up on the website through his website, not through Ticketmaster or Live Nation.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what's on the back end of that website. Is it connected to the record label and the whole machine or not? But it seemed like a way of getting tickets to the fans. They were still expensive.
Yeah.
But not $750.
Wait, no, the Roger Waters, to go through Live Nation, if you want to sit on the floor and not on the sides, was $507.50.
Wow.
And you know, and it was, I mean, they'll throw a poster in, you know.
well, Bob, I
got and I just went there because I said, there's a. That's ridiculous.
I got a question for Bobby about that too, because I know Prince used to do where he had on, you know, his, you'd go to his site and he'd offer special tickets or special things to his, you know, loyal subscribers pre. Is that much of that happening right now as far as bands and concerts?
Yes, but one of the big bitches that people have is the fact that sometimes the fan club isn't really getting that much of a deal. And again, it's artists like Bon Jovi. Bon Jovi, I keep on bringing up, but they're the ones that keep on getting the most flack for this. Hmm. Is where there's supposed to be backstage passes and you know, an after party and everything, and nobody shows up from the band and whatever. So there's a lot of disgruntlement from the fan club, and this is happening with a lot of major artists. So I think that there's a revolution that's happening in that whole end of the business as well, and I think. It's going to start to come to a head if it hasn't already, and you're going to see everything change big time. The other thing is people are very, very sick of paying the extra service charges. Mm-hmm. And I think the one that really gets everyone is when you print a ticket out at home and they charge you an extra $5 for it.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing them a favor. And
garbage fees.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and what they're doing now is they're saying, okay, it's an all-in price. There's no more extras. But they're basically raising it, you know, another 20% to put all that stuff in. But I think you're going to start to see the big-time backlash hitting.
Well, you know, one of the thing, last thing I want to talk about in my Wang Chung epiphany.
You just can't get off that.
No, this is, see, I did some deep thought
some
there.
It's a long drive back.
I know.
Hey, yeah, I did drive to Vegas and back. But they have a new EP. And I was listening to their EP, and it sounds awesome. And I think, to me, that was really cool in the fact that the way technology has progressed on certain things, and one thing being, you know, the recording process, that, you know, some of these acts that are coming out with new stuff are actually going to sound just as good, even better than what you remember. And I think that's going to add some legs to a lot of people's career, is the fact that now they can come out and they can record in digital, and they can get the pristine guitar sounds, and they can get the really great sounding, you know, record that's just as good as what else is out there, you know? And I just think that's important, because a lot of times, you know, in days gone by, you hear an oldie actor releasing something. Well, they didn't have the budget to get into the big studios to work with the best producers and stuff. So their new albums that they wanted to come out maybe didn't sound as good as the studio backed ones. But now the new stuff sounds just as good, if not better, than the old stuff.
You know what? It's absolutely amazing. The music industry amazes me constantly with things like this, because you're sitting here marveling about the fact that their new album sounds as good as the stuff they did 25 years ago, which sounded completely awesome. I mean, like, when Everybody Wang Chung Tonight, you know, they had the multi-track on Synclavier as a demo for a while, and you could hear the individual tracks.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you heard it all over in clubs and the radio and everything else. That record still today sounds absolutely amazingly great.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing that we're marveling that, you know, in their new album, using new technology, they actually sound as good as they did 25 years ago.
Well, but to that, I mean, one of the coolest things on
other industry
site is you've got a rate card from
Electric Lady
from 1978, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
$2,800 a day lockout. Wow. In 1978 dollars.
Wow.
So, in a way, it is sort of amazing, because, first of all, there's no studio that's charging two-thirds of that and actually getting it anymore. I mean, $2,200 is the most I've seen book rate for any place, and this is, we'll do the quick math, 42 years later. So, it is kind of incredible, actually, because those studios aren't around. But they, I mean, who knows where they did it, but probably one of them has a studio. Yeah. And, you know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we can find out. We can ask.
So, yeah, it's very, very sad.
Well, you think about it, though. When you think about how much technology has evolved in the past 30, 35 years, you would kind of expect you'd be able to do it, you know, on your phone now.
But the thing is, I mean, this is a totally different conversation, which we won't really start now. But
I think we should start it right now. That way it's impossible for Mike to edit the
podcast. But how much of the advancement has been sonic? I mean, I think by the time you got to the mid to late 70s, other than noise floor, they'd kind of already done it. Yeah. I mean, you listen to some Oliver Nelson records from back then, there's nothing that sounds better done before then, after then, probably ever will be. Mm-hmm. But the technology is more about the delivery and the storage and all the rest of it.
But I think the cost of the technology has dropped incredibly.
But not the cost of that. I mean,
sure. Acoustics are acoustics, and acoustics haven't changed in price.
But even, like, I mean, my Neve console, because of the way it's built, would be several million dollars if you tried to build it now. So that technology, that cost has not dropped at all. It's hand-wired.
Sure.
It takes forever to build, and the parts are huge with a ton of wire and a bunch of steel. And so what's dropped is the computer stuff and the digital stuff, and that's amazing. So, but it's more apt to compare it to what people did once ADATs came out.
Right.
I think. And that's gotten better.
Yeah, and I just think...
Yeah, that has gotten better.
I just think that was... You know, when you think about it, it just means that years from now, we're all going to be able to do, you know, what we love to do and hopefully keep the quality up to where it is, at least right now.
But can anyone else name an industry that is hoping to get its quality level to where it was 30 years ago?
Politics.
No. Yeah, that's true. Well, hey, listen. On that note, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to visit with Bobby. We're going to talk about some of the books that he has written and a couple other things. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking about, all kinds of stuff.
Wang Chung.
And we ended up on a high note. But we're going to change gears right now. Bobby Osinski is with us, and Bobby has written some amazing books. And Bobby, let's just start. How did you get into the writing business? And can you tell us a little bit of how that evolved to all the different books that you've now written?
Well, I started to write magazine articles, and the first one I wrote was for Mix in 1989. And then I wrote for Film and Video. I did some stuff for Billboard. Just about every magazine you can think of. EQ and REP, right at the end of REP, which is a great magazine. And I noticed that there were no books on mixing at all, anywhere, at least not what I wanted to see. And from doing all these interviews and just being around L.A., I met a lot of people, and I met a lot of my heroes, and they're A-list mixers. I thought, well, I know how to do this a little bit, but they really know how to do it. So let me talk to them and really get, you know, the picture right from their mouth. And so that became a formula that goes through all of my books. It's not that I'm so smart. It's the people I talk to are really smart.
Right.
And as a result, about a third of each book has interviews with, you know, A-list people. So I wrote my first book completely on spec. I just wrote it, and that was The Mixing Engineer's Handbook, and I sent it out to five publishers, and they all wanted it.
Hmm.
And the one that was the most aggressive, which at the time was Mixed Books and Mike Lawson, who's been my champion forever, I went with them. And then it went to the Recording Engineer's Handbook and the Mastering Engineer's Handbook and let's see what else. The Drum Recording Handbook, the Music Producer's Handbook, which just came out, the Touring Musician's Handbook, the Studio Musician's Handbook, Music 3.0, How to Make Your Band Sound Great, which is a band improvement book. And there's probably some others that I can't think of right off. But
So next one should be post-production?
Yeah, you want to be in it?
Crickets.
Now, when you wrote the first one, The Mix Engineer's Handbook, Did you know that it was going to have the impact on the music education that it has had?
Oh, not at all.
I mean, did you – and when you slowly started to see that kind of success, I mean, how did that make you feel? Did that make you feel – obviously great, but at the same time, did you feel like any added pressure going into the next one? Or?
No. No, never. Everyone is fun. I really enjoy it. I can't wait to wake up in the morning and do this because I learn so much. And again, I talk to people that are so much smarter than I am, and that's why it's fun. I learn as much as the people that read the books. So no, there's never any pressure. My first books are still selling as good as ever. Actually, the Mixing Engineer's Handbook is selling better than ever, surprisingly enough. It's in, I don't know, last time I checked, it was 70 or 80 universities all over the world, actually.
But you know what? Yeah. That doesn't surprise me because for a lot of people, that's the only place to get this kind of knowledge because, you know, your studios, they're not exactly popping up around town. And the only place you'll be able to experience some of the techniques and some of the things that you talk about and some of the gear you talk about is really in a book like what you have. And it becomes more and more important, especially because the classic techniques, you know, the mixing on a console, you know, as Andrew, I'm sure you can agree with, you know, it's totally, you take that same information and you put it into your Pro Tools system and you use some of the same techniques with sidechaining and things like that. And it, I mean, am I right, Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just, for a lot of people, there's no place to get this kind of information.
Well, actually, that was another reason why I write these books is I want to have a repository of that information before it goes away. Because let's face it, the way we do things are different than the way they used to be, and they're not necessarily better. Especially in recording, there's a whole generation of kids that have grown up that just know in the box, and they don't know how to record at all. And all that information is falling by the wayside. It used to be you learn stuff because you're in a studio and you're an assistant, and you learn from somebody that was really good.
Right.
And that doesn't happen anymore because there's not that many studios, and the A-list guys – have their own, and they're doing it themselves. So a whole apprenticeship has gone away. So that's why I really want to try to make the books a place where all that information goes before it you know, goes into the ether.
Well, one of the things that I really appreciate in the books is that you take each discipline on its own merits. You got the mix engineers, you got the recording engineer, you got the mastering engineer. I mean, sometimes you read some of the generic books and they kind of lump them all together. And, you know, each one has its own unique challenges and its own unique talents that you need to do that job. And, you're right. For a lot of kids, especially growing up in the digital world that we live in, they don't know any of that. And they don't have their own Bobby Summerfield like we have here, who's a panel member who is our kind of our authority on all things analog, him and Andrew. But it's really important to separate those and to realize what some of the challenges are for each unique, really career. My question is, what surprised you the most between, you know, the first time you wrote the Mix Engineer Handbook and then the revision? Was there things when you wrote the first one that you just had no idea that, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to be leaving this out or we're going to be doing things this way? I mean, obviously tape going away is probably the big thing, but
every revision is kind of like that where you look at it and you say, well, wait a second, 10 years ago we were doing it one way and now it's completely different. And that gear that was so important then, you know, is it in the studio anymore? The big thing I remember especially was when I wrote the first book, the Mixing Engineer's Handbook, the very first one. It was 1998, 99. And the big thing then was 3324s and 3348s. That was it. Every studio had them, and that was kind of the top of the food chain. And they were gone by 1995. And didn't it seem like they just went away like almost overnight?
It was in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually know somebody who paid over $100,000 for a used 3348, and literally a month later it was worth about $5,000.
It's amazing. It's amazing. And I look at all this technology that we're so used to, and I keep on thinking, okay, what's going to be the next 3348?
Really quick, why don't you explain what a 3348 is?
It's a reel-to-reel digital multi-track machine. And so it was the pinnacle of those. An open reel 48-track could do 48K. 24-bit was the last version they did. So
Made by Sony, yeah.
And right when they came out with their 24-bit 48K machine was right around the same time that ADATS happened. And that's what did it.
Wow. So these $100,000 machines are dropping. Can you even get?
Well, they were like $300,000 or $400,000 machines when they first came out.
You would now probably be able to find someone who would give you one for free. Absolutely. If you want one, I'm sure you can find one.
Yeah. Just to get it off their property.
Yeah, right. You go pay to come pick it up.
Well, it weighed like a car. I mean, it was huge.
Yeah.
No, they were awesome machines, though.
I mean, we had two big music facilities we ended up shutting down, and all the gear went right behind my office. And some of it, Andrew has.
Some of it, yeah, my place.
But it was, we would sit there, and you would look, and a lot of – we had 30 Atari machines, Studer machines, digital machines. We still have the mic collection from Radford, but a lot of the stuff – this is stuff we dreamed about. Synclaviers were stacked up. 200 wave frames. I mean, mountains of garbage. But we're sitting there going, my God, I want 11, you know, a lot of vintage outboard gear, which we ended up selling. But some of the stuff, what do you do with? I mean, we still have three waveframe 1000s or two waveframe 1000s in parts. And in the day, they were $150,000, and now they're useless. You know, D88s. We still have a mountain of D88s, 3/4 inches and 1/2 inch machines, which are absolutely useless.
You know, I keep on looking at Pro Tools, and I'm thinking, when is it going to happen to you?
Well, it is. It's that rack. It's all those apples sitting in your closet. I still have 6 apples in my house, and I'm really using 1 or 2, but I can't throw it away. I spent $3,000 on it.
Yeah. Well, yes, unless the companies like Pro Tools, you know, Avid. I was going to say DigiDesign just because I like that name.
Nostalgic,
but Avid. I mean, if they keep progressing with the times, then they'll just keep their legs and they'll keep running with it. Because the thing about Pro Tools is, as long as they are running, they're kind of like leading the race. So,
but there are cool plugins you can't get anymore. We're talking about vintage gear. I remember like a Cantos, and even the new Native Instruments vocoder.
Right,
vocator. They stopped making it. You can't do that. It was an amazing vocoder that they just.
There is such a thing as vintage software, which we always used to joke about.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Running an old machine. I mean, I did it a couple of months ago to transfer all my Synclav sounds.
Yeah.
Booting up a machine out of storage. It was actually my Mac clone from Power Computing.
Remember that?
I had a jazz drive inside of it, hooked my Synclav optical up to it.
What may change, though, that Bobby may be alluding to is that the actual Pro Tools may not be card-based.
Sure.
So there will be a point where it will be host-based because you do the processing. So that will change dramatically.
But the shifts that happened up until then were actual platform shifts where you went from open-reel tape to modular videotape to computers. And is there going to be something past computers? I mean, I don't see it, but, you know, I don't see all kinds of stuff.
We don't know it yet.
So who knows? I mean, most likely computers will just evolve.
Yes.
And it'll be a little bit more organic.
Solid-state drives run
that way. But
mechanical drives.
It could be.
It's amazing how fast these changes happen, though. Like, over at the post place where I mix, you know, we had a $150,000 Fairlight system that got replaced by Pro Tools. And literally, we could not give – and like any other studio, you replace it and you still have this really expensive box. So you put it in another room thinking, oh, we're going to use this for something. We're going to get to it. And then pretty soon you don't plug it in. And then, oh, we got to move it. And you move it to the storeroom. And then years go by and all of a sudden you're like, we got to get rid of this thing, right? And so you're way past its prime. And you end up just taking it to the dump and just, you know.
Yeah, well, and the difference is that those were all purpose-built. Like, you couldn't use a 3348 for anything else.
Right.
Well, use it to hold open a door, keep your car from rolling down a hill. But that's about it. Yeah. Whereas now, I mean, all of the audio stuff that people use are on the same computer. They're doing spreadsheets and email and all the other stuff that isn't going to go away.
Right.
So I think that's where the real difference is. It's just migrated onto your wristwatch, basically.
But I think the difference is when you buy a piece of hardware, it will always be there available in that form. And now it's almost like all the technology we're buying is subscription-based. So you buy it for a length of time. New operating system comes out. It no longer works. It has a very defined life. What's interesting, though, is because we throw out a lot of stuff. Or it's $79 for the upgrade of the plug-in.
Yeah.
And then you keep doing that, and then you find, wow, I'm just constantly paying just to keep up what I already have.
Which plug-in is that, by the way?
That was
pretty much all of them.
Pick one, yeah, right.
Which was that cheap? That's what I wanted to
know. Oh, so, yes. Well, everything's upgradable, but you're paying it every year another... Mm. You know, $1,000 to everything that you own.
But if you're happy with where it is, you could just not upgrade.
That's true.
Run the old stuff. And there are people who do that. There's a fantastic video I saw, which is like a distillation of what goes on the Digi Users Conference, which is the forum on the Avid site for Pro Tools users. And it's this unbelievable conversation about how Pro Tools 7.4 the holy grail. And anything past that's awful. But it's true. I mean, and there are people who will do that, and they'll stick with an older version of it, just like there are people using digital tape still, because they love it.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, why do they say that version is better?
It's the last one that was stable, apparently, even though I've managed to get a bunch of work done in the other versions. I think it was mostly stability.
And also the user interface look. A lot of people didn't like the big switches over
when it went to 8.
Hey, sound looks right now? We're still 7.4.
Are you really? I will say that we're recording this on 7.4, and I have 8.0 in my other studio, and I prefer 7.4.
I've gotten used to 8, but as a colorblind American like myself, I have a harder time seeing things in 8 than I did in 7.4.
I think a lot of it also was there's a big investment when you go to MacTels.
Right.
Then you got to get all your plugins updated. Mm. Some of them won't work. And for us, being the size company that we are, it's not, you know, a small feat to upgrade all of our Pro Tools systems is serious amount of money.
But you know that guy there.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, though, I will say this, though, but 8.0 may be just a patch away from being the holy grail. You know, if they go to 8.11 and all of a sudden, you know, some of the issues that happen go away and it becomes stable, then that's going to happen.
Well, they have all the new hardware now, all the new interfaces that they just released, which only run on 8.3.
Right.
So now if you're going to buy the new hardware, then you have to upgrade.
Well, and you need Snow Leopard, which means you need a new computer, which means you're getting a new setup.
Yes.
But there's also, you can kind of sense when you get away from specific situations like Scott's company having such a huge investment and, you know, how much the upgrades would cost and all that, when you just kind of, for the moment, forget about the cost of upgrading and you just kind of get a sense of how people feel about a version, there's a big push of people out there who just liked the feel and the stability and the whatever else of 7.4. Not people who'd have to spend $1 million to upgrade, and a lot of people who actually had 8 and just didn't love it. I mean, it is weird in software. Every now and then things just kind of come together and a piece of software feels right or wrong. Like Windows Vista, total disaster, even though it basically works for most people. But the sense out there was it was a disaster, and Windows 7 was all of a sudden this incredible, great new thing. But a lot of that is just like the mood of the world about a piece of software. 7.4, for whatever reason, and before that, like, was 6.9 the other one?
Yeah, 6.9 was the one that, everyone said 7.4 is a piece of crap. Right. 6.9 so is the best 6.9. One ever.
Yeah.
You know, but then
it's what you're used to, I guess.
It's what you're used to, and then they patch the parts that actually are bugs, because Avid is super interested in fixing bugs. They're not trying to have buggy software. And every couple years or whatever, another version gets considered to be the holy grail.
Right.
I love 8 myself.
Yeah, and I'm fine with 8 too.
But I mean, all these companies, they have to have a 8, 5, a 9, a 10, 11, 12, because they're in the business to sell units. And it's not in their interest to sell it once and not sell it again.
No, and you just hope that the company realizes that we need to actually give you something you want to buy, so therefore the features are worth getting, which I would say they are.
So far,
for the most part.
So, Bobby, let's talk a little bit now about the future. And where do you think Music 4.0 is going to go? And specifically, you know, when I wrote you the email about some of the stuff I wanted to talk to you about, Wired magazine, I don't know if you guys read Wired, but they have this big thing on the cover that says, "The web is dead." And you think about that, and if you read the article, the author makes some really good points. It's one says the web is dead, and the other says the web is still alive. And it's mainly talking about the, you know, rise of like Facebook and things that don't necessarily rely on the web, you know, their own apps and things like that. And how do you think the whole app thing is going to affect music? Because now not only do you have bands that have downloads of music, but now you're going to have bands that can have downloads of apps, and you can have like a Coldplay app or the Bon Jovi app or the, you know, Andrew Shep's app, you know.
You don't want that.
Well, let's come back for a second on, you know, the whole web is dead thing. I have two blogs. One is a Music 3.0 blog, and I addressed this right after the article came out. And if you look at the chart, the way it looks is everything else has gone down in usage, and video has gone way up, and, of course, social networking has gone way up. But if you really look at it, what happened is all the stuff that seems to have come down is like email. And email, for instance, happens in a burst. It's not continuous like video. So video, of course, is going to have a lot more bandwidth. But when you look, really, it hasn't been that video has displaced anything, because all your other apps are you're using them as much, or if not more than ever. Video is just more, and it's because of the bandwidth, because it's constant use when people look at it.
Right.
So it's not really true that, you know, the web is dead, and all the things that we loved about the web, like email and looking at the web itself, they haven't gone away, and they're not going to. So, you know, it's kind of a fallacy.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's just something you put on a magazine to sell magazines. That's really a stupid thing to say.
Well, yeah, but if you read the article, and they do make a great point. It's the web. I should say more or less the web as we know it is dead. I mean, the internet is still alive and kicking. But
is that what they said? The web as we know it is dead.
It's more about that. It's not. You're going out and looking for things. It's more like we were talking about earlier with discovery. It's apps who are bringing things to you and saying, here's all this information. This little device is going to filter what you need to see.
But
now.
Don't you think the web is so huge? We were talking like music. How do you filter out the crap from the good stuff?
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, there are stores or apps that are coming out, Facebook, and places that you know you can rely on to go to places
But that's what they're saying as part of the whole web is dead thing. It's like now more people are updating their Facebook page from their phone than they are from their computer. So, and that's the app that's on the iPhone. And
I don't know if I'd buy that.
Well, but yeah, you'd be hard to argue that you're not on the web.
And you're on the web when you do that. I'm sorry, but
yeah, I mean, what I see.
We haven't read the article.
Yeah, we should read the article, but it's definitely a stupid headline.
I mean, what I see being a film guy is that mobile technologies or entertainment on demand is reformulating the entertainment industry, where especially video, TV. You got Hulu. You've got the Apple's new TV ability right now. Programmed, you know, the three networks.
Right.
This is the only choice you have. Is the dinosaur in the room? Now all of a sudden, the content's still the content. How you get it to them? If we look at music, we look at TV, we look at film. The artists actually remain the same. It's the people that own the pipe.
Right.
The distribution mediums have totally retransformed themselves. But things that we used to rely on, whether they were record companies or people that helped distinguish product to us, that we can understand, so we limit our choices.
Record stores and video rental stores.
So now TV could be anything. It could be YouTube is becoming a new TV station.
Right.
Where all of a sudden you could look at people's YouTube and be entertained by video instead of watching TV.
Scott, are your clients afraid of Hulu and Google TV especially?
No, I think what's happening is everybody's looking at new distribution mediums.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's happening is the business community, not the artistic, but the business community is trying to define what those mediums are and how are they going to make money in them. I think that at least the TV and film group, for instance, I'm doing a movie called Season of the Witch. And what's interesting is Relativity Media is a, they used to finance all these films. Now they're making their own films. They just made a deal with Netflix. It used to go, a film came out, then it went to maybe HBO, went to DVD. There was a path of the life of it. We just said, you know what? It's going to go from the theaters straight to Netflix, exclusive, $100 million. for Relativity Media. Hmm. So people are kind of going, you know what? I'm cutting out the middle people or the steps that they feel weren't an economic wasn't economically viable anymore.
Right.
So people are now jumping from film straight to alternative mediums. This way people can do Netflix, they could download it on demand, and they felt that Netflix offered a great economic secondary market for them.
But see, that's just – that kind of proves a little bit of the point what they were talking about being the web is dead. I don't think they're not saying the internet is dead, but for instance – like, I don't go to the New York Times website. I use my New York Times app on my iPhone when I read that. I don't go to the Wall Street Journal website. I go to my app. And we're going to be getting our news. We're going to be getting our music, you know, from some app. I mean, it's going to come to that. It's going to be a different way.
But still using the internet, though.
No. We're using the internet. And we're not talking about the internet dying. I think, you know, what the point of view is the web is going to a browser page and going to, you know, a specific, you know,
that's
browser
exactly
page.
Browser. Yeah,
but you got an app that goes directly to the content.
But exactly.
But you've got a medium that's like a book that instead of reading it on a computer that you can't move around,
right.
Now it's what's interesting about apps is they're dedicated to a specific hardware or specific means.
Yes,
well, but I think more importantly to a specific source of information. If you go to the New York Times site, you're as likely to also see if there's a story about it on CNN, see if there's a story about it on some other news site.
Right.
If you're inside the app, you're not doing that. You're That's staying true. On the New York Times feed, which
right.
is interesting because it's the opposite of the liberation of information that happened with websites.
You know what?
Exactly. And how's that going
to – not to go against a – horribly named, probably interesting article that I still need to read. The truth is the line between – basically, apps are today's version of what desktop software was, you know, a couple decades ago. And with the internet, we're always going to be walking the line between things that are publicly served, like web pages, and apps, which are individual applications. And the truth is, with HTML5 and a lot of what's coming – in web development, and I know this because I'm living it every day,
right.
There are a lot of ways to build web-based apps that feel like individual apps on a device but are device-neutral and a lot more sort of generically usable on a lot of different platforms. And a lot of companies don't want to have to develop for Android and iPhone and whatever other platforms come out. So for today, yes, there's a lot of excitement about apps, and you'll see plenty of people walking around with, you know, hundreds of apps that they're never going to use on their devices just because they seemed cool at the time. Sorry, Mike. And
I use every single one of them, just so you know.
Yeah, and so does Bobby. He's not here to defend himself, which is why I can make fun of him unapologetically. But the truth is it does ebb and flow between things being centrally served on web pages and individual apps. Right now things seem very app-centric, but HTML5 – I mean Flash actually, if it had been a little more streamlined and hadn't gotten on – Steve Jobs' bad side early on, Flash was a way to develop web-centric apps that ran almost like an individual app on your device. The problem is it's too bloated and it's kind of buggy and old and really needs more than a facelift. But HTML5 and some of the things that are still being formalized as part of that standard and some of the things that are coming as adjunct technologies with HTML5 are going to make it where you can run some things on your browser that feel like apps. An app. And there are some things that, like, Google Chrome does some tricks. They've sort of adopted some parts of what they think are going to be future standards. And you can find some websites out there that only work on Chrome because no other browsers are as compliant with these technologies. But they really run like apps, and you'd be shocked to find out they're just websites.
Has everyone seen the Arcade Fire video?
Yes.
Yeah, there's a good example.
Yeah, good example of HTML5.
Yeah.
And for those of you who haven't seen it, what it is it you go on Arcade Fire, it's their latest video, I don't remember what the name is, but it asks you to put the address of your, I guess, the home where you grew up. And then what it does, multiple windows come up as the video goes along, but using Google Earth, pictures from the address that you put in pop up as well. So you're basically your former home is in that video.
That's cool.
It's very
really cool.
Really cool. Yeah.
And the thing is, HTML5 is not I think Steve Jobs did a real disservice by making it seem like you have two options, Flash and HTML5, because they're not at all comparable animals. They're just not. They're two totally different ideas, different kinds of technologies. But as far as the end user is concerned, you can accomplish some of what you could with Flash with HTML5, and they're still building HTML5. You know, no one knows exactly where it's going to end up just yet, but it has the potential of being a way for apps for you to have centrally driven apps where you don't actually have to develop for a lot of technologies. Because let's face it, as there are more and more Android devices and iPhone devices, and there's going to be other competition besides those, no one's going to want to get into that market if it means you have to develop an application for each of those platforms. It's really expensive.
Right. So, Bobby, where do you think we're going? Give us a little future, a little...
If I knew, I'd be a rich man.
You're a smart man.
Well, again, what I see is the same thing I was talking about before. In a way, it's back to the future because the walls are tumbling down.
Right.
And we're seeing a new generation of record label owner and promoter and just the whole infrastructure that rose to a point where it couldn't rise any longer, where it's exploding. Now it's coming back around and the new blood is coming in on the bottom. It's going to take some time for that to develop, but it's starting to happen. I did a record a couple years ago for Amon Tobin. I mixed the record. Amon's a worldwide noted artist of electronica. And he records for a label called Ninja Tune in Toronto. And when we were mastering, the owner of the label was coming down, and I was expecting a typical label owner. And this guy came in, and he had shorts, and he had tats and all over the place, and he was a young guy, and he was his audience. And he knew his audience. He knew what everybody wanted because that's what he wanted. And he was so hip, and I thought, this is the future. This is the way to go. This is the way it used to be.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I really think that that's what's happening. I mean, I could see it. There's so many small labels that are just like that.
Right.
They just don't have the juice yet, but they're getting it.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
One thing that I want to talk to you, and the last thing we're going to talk about, and I want to get your perspective, particularly Bobby, because you've seen a lot of change and you've been able to take a lot of this change and put it in your books and explain what's happening. And I want to open this up to the panel too, is what advice would you give people out there that are starting out, not just to get a job, but to have a career in audio, be it film or be it music or post-production? Because I will tell you just from my own experience that as I look back and, I was thinking how long I've been into audio, and I've been doing this from when I first started touring, over 20 years. And it was like, wow, it's a wacky little career that I have here. And I can see all the technology changes that have helped me, and they've mostly helped me. I've really benefited from a lot of technology, especially going to DAWs and especially on the touring side with MIDI and things like that. Technology has always progressed my career. And what advice would you give somebody who's fresh out of school, who's looking for not just a job, a career?
Let me be more specific on that. Let's talk about the growth industries within the music industry, because there's only one, and it's social networking. When I was writing Music 3.0 and doing the interviews, this kept on coming up over and over. And one of the things that everybody was talking about was the new Fifth Beatle. Used to be the Fifth Beatle was a George Martin type or, a Billy Preston type or something like that. Now the new Fifth Beatle is the guy that does the social networking. He's the webmaster. And every artist that's coming up needs that, because it gets to the point where even if you're very, very hip yourself, it takes so much time that you get to the point that you go, I can either do this or I can write music. And of course it's an easy choice at that point.
Right.
So you can't effectively do everything yourself. So you need somebody that's very connected with the band that can do all that. And it's also a growth industry within all of the labels. No matter big or small, indie or major, it doesn't matter. It's a big growth industry because everybody knows that that's the future. You have to communicate with the fans, and social networking is the best way. Now, social networking isn't the only way.
Right.
Because one of the things that's kind of overlooked is the fact that your email list is more powerful than any social network. is. And building that is really important. What ends up happening is a lot of bands will get, you know, a million fans for MySpace, Facebook, whatever it might be. And if they don't translate that or capture all those into their mailing list, they've made a horrible mistake. Because what will happen is if one of those things go away, they're done. They lost that whole list. They lost all their friends. There's a good example. I can't think of the name of the band right now, but they had like over a million friends. And when they signed their major label deal, the label said, oh, just get rid of the MySpace. You know, we're going to do it ourselves. We're going to do a label one.
Oh, that was brilliant.
That's right. So, and they lost all of those fans. They couldn't get them back.
Wow.
And that's why it's so important that you have to capture those, put them on your mailing list, and you can directly touch the people, and they can touch you back. So, again, the real growth industry is in social media. It's in social networking.
And would you say that that's replaced traditional promotion and radio in terms of getting your music out there, or is it just in addition to?
No, it's replaced it in a way because, let's face it, radio is pretty much dead. In terms of breaking new music, well, unless you're a priority for a major, which there are so few of those, it's kind of dead for you. But social networking is the only way to get out there so you're discovered, so you're in whatever niche you're in.
Right.
And that's the only way you can do it.
But don't you see, it seems like, you know, I'm a bit of a kid of the 60s. So I remember, for some reason I remember Toad. The DJ Toad. Hey, this Toad, you know. And remember, he was always introducing us to new music. So what you found was there are the musicians who are amazing and there's people that just stand out. Then there are people who, you know, played music but just realized at some point of their life they're not going to be the rock star. But they love music so much. Mm-hmm. So you can either be the artist or you can be the enthusiast who likes to talk about the artist. And then those people became valuable because all of a sudden you said, I love this guy's taste, and he's introducing me to stuff. So now we've still got the artists. They're still out there. What we don't seem to have, that is the star people that say, here's the guy that's going to help you find. Because in the 60s, everyone's still finding, you know.
You actually have that, Scott.
Dick Clark, the Dick Clark of the day, you know.
But you have blogs now and stuff. Yeah. You have other options.
But it's a little bit different. You know, you guys familiar with Scott Godin? Scott Godin is one of – he's probably the premier marketing guy on the internet. He's had a number of bestsellers. But he has a theory called the theory of your tribe. Your tribe is your fan base, but they're – in some cases they're called your super fans, uber fans. It could be called whatever. But they're those people. And I know you're saying there's one person like an FM DJ.
Look what Clark did to music. I mean,
you're talking about one person in particular. Yeah. I know that.
But essentially,
what you're having now is you're having those 10 people that are so into your music that they're going out and they're actually capturing other people for you. Their enthusiasm is pulling other people in. That's kind of the whole secret. You get those super fans and you cultivate them, and then your market grows from there. But you have to know them, you have to be able to cultivate them, and you have to be able to feed them what they need.
But those people, whether you look at the Ed Sullivans, the Johnny Carsons, the Dick Clarks, people that really introduced the world to a lot of entertainment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So those people haven't been established yet are known nationally.
They won't be. They were on one of three things you could watch.
It's a different world.
So I don't – that but, is absolutely never going to happen.
But you don't think that a there could be a star, somebody off the net?
Ryan Seacrest is the closest to it, and he's not breaking music.
I think they're all there, but they're much smaller. The Dick Clark is smaller, and the audience is smaller.
Yeah, because they're more specialized. There are blogs that are specialized with real tastemakers for each genre,
right?
But they don't cover all genres.
And the idea that each band kind of has their own group of those people that's only for that band. And maybe a couple of those people do the same thing for a few bands. But it's like the kid who would always be in that indie record store that you would go into and say, dude, have you checked out the blah, blah, blah?
That's right. Yeah.
I listen to guys like –
I love the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I mean, I would listen to people like that as much as I would listen to anybody else. So I think they're still around. But yeah, there's no platform.
So if you look at – like really, because I think there's a lot of start the college age.
Right.
Where there becomes somebody in the college universe of that people tend to gravitate to, that go, oh man, I always go to this website because they offer me something that I really dig.
Well, colleges are still the holy grail of breaking new acts. Right. That hasn't changed, actually.
But the more people I talk to lately, the more they're saying that even college radio is not breaking music anymore. Right.
No, not college radio, just college kids.
Well, yeah. So you
word of mouth. Right. Yeah. But what I'm saying is what people still need the same thing.
No, I just do not. I don't think they do. I think so they're old.
The question is, what vehicle do you see that filters out those? We were talking about before. That's what the record labels did. It filtered the good entertainment from the not so good entertainment, potentially. What filters, what medium filters that for specific audiences?
You know, you're going to laugh when I tell you this, but for a while, I thought that the future of music was AM radio. And the reason why AM. And this is before
this was in the 40s?
No. This is right before talk radio really caught on big.
Right.
And AM was floundering. And it was like, well, if you got those same sort of FM DJs and you put them on radio, on AM, it doesn't matter if it sounds crappy. You'll get a bunch of people that are coming there. Because the cool thing about FM radio is the fact that what you listened for was the DJ because you trusted the DJ's taste.
Yes.
And you didn't care what he played, but you knew it was going to be cool most of the time.
Right.
Now, you don't have those platforms anymore, but again, for half a second, I thought maybe it would be AM where, you know, there's not a lot going on. Now, of course, you have talk radio, and it's kind of gone crazy there.
For years, I've become a fan of NPR.
Yeah.
Because NPR and BBC,
well, they kind of
it's
do
for
that.
News. Yeah. It's kind of like, look, yeah. I don't want to hear about all the crap that keeps going on in the news.
Right.
You know, I don't care what Britney Spears is doing. I just want all that to go away. I want to understand a sophisticated approach to what's going on. And I found that NPR and BBC gave me that.
Yeah,
so right. I featured with
BBC too?
Yeah, but BBC could be really depressing. You know, the Congolese children, right. Warrior children, you know.
No, for music.
It's all for, you know. And I think what happens, though, is I like that. So satellite radio for my audience,
right.
All of a sudden, it gave me something that I really wanted.
What do you listen to specifically, though, on satellite?
I've got Sirius because it goes with my car.
Okay.
But when I had normal radio, I hated it. I never listened to it.
Yeah.
And then I used to listen to music a lot of iPod. Now I have to admit I'm listening to a lot of NPR. I do a lot of driving. A lot of NPR, occasionally Comedy Central,
right.
Music different times. But I want, like music, I'm tired of hearing the same music over and over and over.
Same cuts.
For years, I just hated it. I want to hear something that I specifically enjoy.
Yeah.
And I think that I don't know where to turn. I know where to turn for news.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know where to turn for music.
Well, it's on the same channel, KCRW.
I'll tell you what, a really simple way that I use to find a lot of new music, and this might be a little too simple, but I just use a lot of times the iTunes reviews. And if I go to an artist that I like and I read, and then every once in a while you got to wade through the reviews, but then this reviewer say, hey, this is great. And if you like this, it's very similar to that. And then you go to that one and you're going, hey, look. And then they go, hey, people have bought this, have also bought that. And it's a good way for me to find a lot of different music out there. And then you can hear the sample right there.
I've spent half a day doing that.
Right.
Sometimes it's nice to have someone do it for you.
That's what we were saying before, though, is that it's become an active pursuit. And what you were saying before is that what will sort of change the game is when someone comes up with a way for you to be passive again.
Exactly.
But it will be tuned towards the individual, and it won't be a national
market, sure, absolutely.
Well, hey, gang, we're going to have to wrap this up because I could stay talking. We're going to have to bring you back on, Bobby, I think we need to go into what I originally wanted to say is, like, what kind of tools does the young engineer need nowadays to have that long career? And what, you know, and obviously being aware of all the social networks is one of them too. But, you know, a quick example is I look at Rob. He's not just a musician and a songwriter, but he also is into web and does programming and things like that and kind of keeps his career alive by, you know, being able to hopscotch around to different things, as well as I know, you know, Andrew does too. And it just seems as we move on into the future, you just have to have way more tools in your tool.
It's called adapt or die, basically.
Yeah. You have to be a generalist anymore, really.
Yeah. Well, we have to have Bobby back for Bobby 2.0.
That's right. We do.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah.
There's way too much more. But thank you so much for joining us. And Gary, thank you so much for coming on also, and for bringing Bobby. And just thank you for writing those books, really. You know, you've done
a great service.
Seriously, it's really great. And I really want to encourage all the listeners out there too. We'll put a link up to Bobby's blog, and why don't you talk a little bit about your blog?
Well, I have two blogs, actually. One is bobbyosinski.blogspot.com. I had to think for a second what it was. And that's mostly a music production blog. Lately, what I've been doing with it is putting up a lot of isolated tracks from hits from, could be long ago, could be recently, and kind of doing an analysis. And everybody's really liked those, so I'm going to continue to do that 3 or 4 times a week.
Oh, that's great.
And the Music 3.0 blog is more about the music industry and what could help musicians in their social networking and just general industry view.
Great.
Yeah, and that's music3.0.blogspot.com. Music with a 3, number 3, point, P-O-I-N-T.
We'll put a link. Don't worry about it.
/. It's getting like that almost.
We'll put a link on it. But I do want to encourage you, if you haven't read any of those books, the Mix Engineering, Recording Engineering, or Mastering Engineering, go out and buy it. You know, you don't even have to, don't even flip through it. Just go grab it and buy it. Cause it's something that you want to have around you. And it's a great reference. And it, like I said, he's really done a great service. So thank you.
Thank you kindly, Mike.
For joining us. Rob.
Yes, Mike.
You know what? We got to give Bobby a round of applause.
Oh, thanks,
guys.
And you know what? I have to say, we have to give Gary a round of applause because he got ripped off at the beginning of the podcast. So, ladies and gentlemen, one more time for Gary Mraz.
Thank you very much.
Okay, that's enough.
So, Rob, you working on anything you can talk about? Or is it going to be a... I can't talk
No,
about
I'm working on a few things.
Great.
Which should be public by the time this is out, I think. Well, for one thing, we've been working on an album with an artist named Tasha Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Her father was a blues legend named Johnny Taylor, and we just finished an album with her that is coming out any moment, and some really cool videos and some other good stuff for that. So, Tasha, I just gave you your first official shout-out.
Nice.
And so we did that. Our Old Navy campaign that I wrote the music for is on the air, and there's more of that kind of stuff to come.
Great.
Which I'm excited about. It's been a while, like I said last time, since we've been in the commercial game, so it's fun to be doing that. And actually, at our at the Noisy Neighbors website, a lot of these spots are going to start showing up. Of course, I'm busy building websites for everybody else, but the NoisyNeighbors.com website is going to be updated shortly with some cool stuff to see and hear. What else? Still doing stuff with Google. You know, I talked about the trip I made up there, and that is a very exciting relationship. I'm very excited about that.
Nice.
As an audio guy and a computer geek and a food maven.
I was going to say.
No better place on earth to eat, folks. Google headquarters. And what else? I think that's it for this week.
So nothing, basically.
Nothing going on.
Andrew,
it's been a little slow.
Tell us about your EP.
Well, okay. Put out a 4-song EP for a band from Oakland called Audrey Sessions, with Audrey spelled wrong, A-U-D-R-Y-E. Very cool. It's basically, we've been working on an album, and the singer is moving out of the country. So the band played their final show last Friday, and we decided to put the EP out on Tuesday, and it was live on iTunes on Wednesday. So that's a good part of what's gone on. And we're actually going to finish the record. We decided we're going to go up this coming weekend and record the rest of it, put it out, just to do it, because we love the music, and we're going to do that. Also, I'm going to be teaching a class at UCLA Extension in January.
Wow. Yeah.
So apropos to a lot of this conversation, it is I don't remember exactly what it's called, but it's Recording Engineering Theory. It's a classroom class about recording. So there's a lot of talking, and this is what a microphone is. And then the second half of the class is listening to stuff and whatever. So come on down.
Well, are you a strict teacher? Are you like, hey, no talking?
People don't talk because I'm so fascinated.
No, that means they're asleep.
Yeah. No, it's so far. I mean, I've taught it a few times. It's a lot of fun.
That's true.
So
well, and you want to be there. It's not like people are being forced to be there.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And it's part of their certificate program in recording. If you decide or music production, independent music production. And without sounding too much like Fareed Zakaria, I'd like to recommend a book. If that's all right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm reading a book called Predictable Irrationality, which I cannot remember the author's name, but maybe you'll put a link up on the site with the thing. It is basically about how consumers' brains work, and it has a lot of amazing stuff about how you set price points in your head and how you bargain for things and what sort of things you do. But one of the things that scared the hell out of me was a thing called anchor pricing, where every consumer gets a price in their head of what they think is fair for a commodity. And it's usually the first price you pay for something. And the anchor price for music right now is free. So it's a great book just to read because it teaches you a lot about yourself. Because, I mean, 90% of what's in there, you go, oh, wow, I do that.
But just don't read it late at night.
There's a lot of information for people trying to figure out how to sell their own stuff.
Right.
A lot of great stuff about how you should price things, how you should advertise things, how you compare it to other things. And so it's a great book.
Wow.
Yeah, I'll shut up now.
No, man. Hey, you know what? You can talk anytime you're here, you know. Come on down. Brandon.
Hey. Working on a couple trailers now. We got a couple Action in the Mechanic with Jason Statham and Faster with the Rock, which have been fun to sound design. And also this sort of sci-fi superhero thing called I Am Number 4.
Cool.
So, yeah, a lot going on.
Gary, how about you? You've got a new Studio Voodoo?
I do, yeah. Actually, it's album number 7, and I did it in conjunction with an artist called Larissa Stowe and Shakti Tribe, and she's really just an amazing study in how to make it in the industry. She's a she sings kirtans, which is an Mideastern call and response. She sings in Hindi, but Studio Voodoo's always had that sort of ethnic history to it. But she'll play a yoga studio by herself with a harmonium, or she'll play a 10,000 venue earth dance with a band, or she'll play an electronica thing, which is what my album is with her. It's an electronica dance club mix. So she's adapted herself to play in a multitude of genres and be very flexible, and she'll play 3 times a week. So she's sort of like the poster child of how to make it really in multiple areas with her music, and it's really wonderful to be part of her stuff. And it is Studio Voodoo.
And when is that out? Or is it out?
It's
right here.
Oh, it's right out. There. It's out.
It's out.
Cool.
It's everything I have since I'm not signed on DTS anymore is at CD Baby. So that's how people, you know, purchase my music.
And I am one of the original largest Studio Voodoo fans. That stuff is just so cool.
You're not that big.
I'm not that huge. But I do remember that first album. It changed my life as far as surround music.
It's one of the few things that when I walked into Rob's house, he said, you've got to hear this.
Yeah, that's true.
He's done that maybe 3 times.
You know, oddly enough, actually, it must have been good because I still sell a ton of it from because if you like surround sound 5.1 music, there's not a lot of original stuff that was really made. There's all remixes, you know, Don Henley, et cetera, remix of stereo.
Yeah.
So they still come back to my stuff, and it was released in 2001.
And I mean, you can play it for somebody today and tell them it was done yesterday, and they'd believe it.
There's no vocals in the sense of traditional, you know, lyrics. It's all very ethnic, and so it's sort of timeless.
It's so cool.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
It's an evergreen product.
It is.
They would say.
It's recyclable.
Yeah. Scott, hello. What are you working on? What kind of fun and exciting things?
What am I doing? You know, I've gone to a lower gear, which is absolutely marvelous. Spending lots of time with my son, but video game wise, I'm finishing up Epic Mickey.
Oh, great!
I can say that works since they've announced it, which is actually an amazing product. It's a Mickey Mouse gone evil, and but what's interesting, you talk about reinventing. Disney looked at Mickey Mouse in today's genre, and they went, no one's interested. So they've taken a spin on Mickey where he loses his heart, and the whole concept of the game is getting Mickey back to become a good Mickey Mouse. But through all of it, Mickey turns evil. And
this an analogy for something like
that? No, no, but it's actually because the animation...
Does he slip anyone a Mickey is what
the animation looks like old Fantasia.
Well, is Minnie into it? That's what I want to know.
You know, actually, you know what they've done is, in this, and I can't, probably can't say too much, but there's a lot of, like, animated versions of animatronics. So, you know, it's very cool. The look of it is old style Disney. The composer's guy named Jim Dooley over at Hans Zimmer's place, which is absolutely fantastic. This guy has nailed the Disney sound. He gives me, 20 stereo tracks. I'm mixing it. I start mixing next week. And it's just, it's a ton of fun just capturing that sound. And It's just a really good time, and believe it or not, it's back. I started in a week and a half back on Season of the Witch.
Wow.
Yes, just because it's been gainfully employing me for over a year.
Wow.
And they've got another take on it, and I don't know. I think it's releasing, I can't say. But they would like it to release soon, but who knows. They've been saying that for a year.
Wow. Well, you have to let us know when it actually does get released.
But you know, they just got finished doing reshoots. I think it was like 15, 20 more minutes. And from the storyboards, it looked actually very good. I like what they were doing, but who knows?
Wow, that's great. And Bobby, your latest book, you want to plug your latest book?
Well, let me plug my latest production first. I did a I usually do one big project a year anymore, and it's like a passion project, sure. Like you were saying. This one actually had a pretty good budget behind it for a band called Snoo, a hard rock band. And it came out a couple months ago, and it's on 250-odd stations. And wow. It's kind of, you know, it's doing pretty good. So so I'm pretty happy about that.
That's great.
I produced that. And my latest book is The Music Producer's Handbook that just came out a couple weeks ago.
Great. Well, I will look forward to reading that.
And you know what? I have to give you a plug, too. I actually read the Mastering Engineers handbook. That was awesome.
Oh, thanks.
Great.
Thanks.
And you know what? That must be awesome, because Rob does not read a lot of books
and
magazines.
I don't ever. I get no magazines and don't read that many books. But
wow, that's a big plug.
We ended up wanting to get into more mastering at my place, and I've ended up mastering a ton of stuff since reading the book, and it definitely made a difference.
Excellent.
And wow. One of the cool things about it was it showed me how to use gear that I already had in a new way, because I just had never thought like a mastering engineer before.
Yeah.
Cool. Cool. Well, hey, Mike.
Yeah.
What are you up to?
Yeah, Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Well, I'll tell you a couple exciting things. Number one, I'm working with Martin on his next album that he's coming out with, and I've been going over to his studio.
That would be Martin Page?
Martin Page, okay, that's okay. Right. Some great stuff, some really good stuff. And as I progress and he lets me give updates, I will give more updates. One thing that's really kind of cool is Martin, his guitar sound is, and I posted a picture of this on our Facebook page, but he uses a ton of those tiny little amps, little practice amps like Orange and Vox and Fender, and that's his guitar sound. He mics that thing and just gets an amazing sound off these little amps, and I just thought that was genius. I called it the curb of sound, not the
you
wall
can drive
of sound,
because
it was so literally. It's not higher than 10 inches each one of them, so that's kind of cool and that's kind of exciting. So I've been working on that, and that's kind of fun, and we're doing some things that I'll talk about a little bit later. And then just, you know, commercials and radio stuff. And but I do want to give a couple plugs out before we go. One is one of our listeners, and I really want to help the listeners that we do have out there promote their stuff. And Jack Broad actually sent us some CDs, so I've got some CDs for everybody. But he's a really active listener on our Facebook. He posts some stuff. He actually suggests a couple of show topics and things like that. He came out with a CD, so you might want to check it out. If you're into jazz, into like electronic or guitar jazz, that's the way his CD is all about. It's really kind of cool. So I want to plug Jack on that, because he's always been a faithful listener for as long as I can remember.
Do you have a link on our page to
no,
his stuff?
But you can find him on our friends, and I'll probably put a link up, you know, either on the actual Audio Outcast Facebook page or on our website. So
cool.
We'll be doing that. And the other thing I want to tell you is that if you haven't sent that email for the Wing Chung CD, Don't send it because it's probably gone by now.
check the email. See if you got one yet.
No, that would be impressive.
That would be impressive because it is not posted yet.
Exactly.
All right. So I just want to thank everybody for listening. And once again, Bobby, thank you so much for joining us. It was great. Gary, thanks a lot. And for myself. And really quick, before we go, if you have any questions or comments, and if you want to reach us, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And also check out our Facebook page. And I do want to say, if any of you guys get our feed, and I know a lot of you do because I see the stats off of iTunes, we could really use some more reviews. All right. That's all. We've got like two.
Hook us up.
And I know we got a feed of like at least 1,500 come right off of the iTunes, you know. So a couple reviews wouldn't hurt.
Would it kill you to say something nice?
That's right. That's right. Just a couple guys.
That's all we're asking.
You know, last time I asked if we can get more than 100 Facebook friends, and boom, we did that. So now just a couple reviews would be great. And also, if you are in the LA area and you want to come in and sit in with us and kind of watch the mayhem that's going on, feel free to drop us an email because, Jeremy.
Hey.
It can happen, right?
It does happen.
See?
Dreams do come true.
And unfortunately, this one did.
Do you think you could fade up When You Wish Upon a Star behind those
bars? That'd be so nice. All right. Well, for myself and all the guys, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.